Hello, everyone. Today, I'm honored to welcome Dr. William Lane Craig to the podcast. Dr. Craig is Emeritus Research Professor of Philosophy at Talbot School of Theology and one of the world's most influential philosophers of religion. With a career spanning decades, he has authored and edited more than 30 books and published over 100 scholarly articles in philosophy and theology. His works include The Kalam Cosmological Argument, Reasonable Faith and God Overall. Beyond his writings, Dr. Craig is perhaps best known for his public debates with leading intellectuals and atheists, including Christopher Hitchens and Sam Harris. His debates and conversations have shaped global discussions on faith, philosophy, and science. In 2016, he was recognized by the best schools as one of the 50 most influential living philosophers. In today's conversation, Dr. Craig and I will be exploring a profound question at the heart of moral philosophy. Does morality require a divine lawgiver? Dr. Craig, welcome to the IJK podcast. It's a real privilege to have you with us.
Oh, my pleasure. It's good to be with you.
Thanks again. We're very happy to talk to you today. I suggest we start by setting the stage a little bit before we go into deeper topics. Dr. Craig, how would you define morality?
Well, I would say that morality is concerned with the content and the grounds for the good and the right. So that's how I would understand it.
Okay. Do you distinguish between objective and subjective morality?
Do I? Yes.
Okay. And do you think in reality, morality should be objective?
Well, I think that morality is objective. I think that we apprehend in our moral experience a realm of objectively existing moral values, and we sense the demand of the moral law upon us, that we have certain duties to fulfill and things we ought not to do. And I think that these are objectively grounded in the nature and commands of God, who objectively exists, and therefore the demands of morality are objective and not merely subjective.
Okay, that's really helpful. Now, let's look at your central argument. You said that objective morality requires God. Can you walk us through the reasoning behind this claim?
Yes, I think that the existence of God provides the best explanation for objective moral values and duties. When you look at alternative accounts of morality, I think none of them is as plausible and explanatorily deep as is theism. And so for me, theism is the preferred account.
Okay. Of course, no conversation about morality and God would be complete without bringing some objections, namely the Euthyphro dilemma. And it says that is something moral because God commands it, or does God command it because it's already moral? How do you respond to this dilemma?
I say that the Euthyphro dilemma is a false dilemma. It is not of the form A or not A. It's of the logical form A or B, and therefore we are always able to craft a third alternative, C. So this is the strategy of splitting the horns of the dilemma. You find a third option, and I would say that morality is neither based upon God's simple will, nor does God will what is good independently of him. My option is that God is the good. He is what Plato called the good, the paradigm and standard of moral value, and that his commands then constitute for us our moral duties as reflections of the will of this absolute good.
Okay, I see. So by positing that God is himself the standard of goodness, you are able to solve the Euthyphro dilemma.
Yes.
Okay, that's fascinating. Now, I can imagine that some listeners, thinking more on everyday terms, would say something like the following: if morality requires God, how do we make sense of the fact that many atheists live very ethical lives?
Because morality is not subjective, as I've already said. If God exists and is the basis for objective moral values and duties, then it doesn't matter whether you believe in him or not. There are still things that are objectively good or evil. You still have moral responsibilities to fulfill. Other persons are possessors of inherent moral human rights and dignity, whether you think so or not. So if morality does not depend upon human opinion, then of course atheists and unbelievers are able to live good and decent moral lives and to discharge their moral duties. So it is the very objectivity of morality that ensures that the lives of atheists are valuable and that they have moral responsibilities and human dignity.
I see. So we are distinguishing here, like, believing in God and believing in the source of morality versus actually living it. It's two different things, correct?
So yes,
this ontology and epistemologies are two different things with this regard.
Yes, you're exactly right. The question here is not whether belief in God is essential to objective morality. The question is whether God's existence is necessary for objective morality. And so the argument is entirely about what is called moral ontology, that is to say, the grounding of moral values and duties. It is not about moral epistemology, that is to say, how we come to know our moral duties or the content of the moral good. It's all about ontology.
Okay. Now there's also the question of how morality unfolds over time. And history gives us some examples, like let's talk about slavery, for instance. For instance, it took centuries for many Christians to recognize slavery as wrong. From a theistic perspective, how do you explain these kinds of shifts in moral understanding over time, regardless of, you know, how we explain morality in terms of ontological terms? But when it comes to practical applications and to be consistent with our beliefs, how do us Christians can make sense of those changes in morality over times?
What we want to say, I think, is that there is an absolute moral ideal which God exemplifies and which we more or less successfully try to live up to. And I think in the progress of human history, people have come to realize more and more fully the moral ideal. And so often ancient societies, particularly those unaffected by biblical religion, are very primitive morally. And I think there has been a greater and greater realization of the moral ideal in our lives.
I see. Okay. Dr. Crick, so far we've looked at why objective morality points to God. And of course, there are some competing theories in philosophy that try to explain morality without invoking God. Now for the rest of this episode, I would like to walk through some of the main ones, and I'd love to hear your opinion on these. You know, most of them are popular and well-known theories. So let's start with moral Platonism. So some philosophers like Eric Weilenberg suggest that moral values just exist on their own, kind of like numbers or abstract truth, without any need for God. So what is your response to that way of thinking?
Moral Platonism has the advantage of being a moral realism, just like theism. It affirms the objectivity of moral values and duties. But my argument would be that moral Platonism is not as explanatorily adequate as is theism. In the first place, I think it's very difficult to understand how moral values can simply exist as abstractions. I understand what it means to say that a person is just, but I draw a complete blank when somebody just says, in the absence of any people, justice exists, or loyalty, or fidelity, or kindness just exist. I have no idea what it means to say that these abstract objects exist in the absence of any persons. This is especially strange when you think that justice is not itself just. It doesn't do anything. So if justice isn't just, then in the absence of any people, how does justice exist? Well, that's one problem I have. The second one would be that I don't think that it provides any basis for objective moral duties. It gives you objective moral values, but it doesn't answer the question, who or what imposes upon me moral obligations or prohibitions? I mean, presumably on Platonism, moral vices also exist as abstract objects, things like rapacity, greed, cruelty also exist. Why am I obligated to align my life with one set of these abstract objects than with another? I cannot see any basis at all in Platonism for moral obligations and prohibitions. And then finally, I think that it is an utterly implausible coincidence that the natural realm and the moral realm, which are independent of each other, should just happen to mesh perfectly, that just that sort of creature should emerge from the blind evolutionary process who corresponds to the objectively existing realm of abstract moral values. That's an incredible coincidence when you think about it. I think it's far more plausible to think that both the moral realm and the natural realm are under the hegemony of a moral lawgiver and a natural law creator than that these two realms just happened to mesh by coincidence.
Okay, I see. Now, another explanation that people give is evolution or evolutionary ethics. So philosophers like Michael Ruse argue that morality is simply the product of natural selection. So basically, traits that helps us survive as a society and to get along better over time. Why wouldn't that be enough to explain right and wrong?
Mm-hmm. I think that this attempt to ground ethics does not give us objective values and duties. Rather, on this view, human morality is just a spin-off of the evolutionary process. Animals which exhibit cooperative and even altruistic behavior, like baboons and even elephants and pigs, have a survival advantage in the struggle for survival. And so in the course of human evolution, there has evolved a sort of herd morality among Homo sapiens, which is useful in the perpetuation of our species. But to regard that morality as objective is to be guilty of speciesism, thinking that our species is somehow favored and objective. And there's no basis for that in naturalism. If you were to rewind the film of human evolution and shoot it anew, a very different creature with a very different set of moral values might well have evolved. And with what right could we say to them that our morality is objective and theirs is not? Michael Ruse himself says it's very plausible that on some planet in outer space, there could be extraterrestrials, among whom a moral code has evolved in which rape is not evil, but is something that is good. And in that case, we would have no basis if these extraterrestrials were to come to Earth and begin to copulate with human females for saying to them that what they are doing is morally wrong. They would say your morality is just the result of blind evolutionary processes. It has no claim upon us, and therefore we simply choose to ignore it. So this is really a kind of anti-realism about moral values that I think flies in the face of our moral experience.
Why do so many philosophers nowadays like this theory? I mean, we always hear like that evolution now explains everything, and now they're trying to use evolution to explain also morality. Why is it so much attractive to most philosophers nowadays?
Well, one reason would be that it's naturalistic, which is appealing to philosophers who are physicalists and do not believe that there is anything beyond the physical world. And it gives you a kind of pseudo-objectivity in the sense that these moral values have, I don't even like to call them moral values. They're not really values, they're just mores, these social mores have objectively evolved among Homo sapiens. They really do have this sort of herd morality that is conducive to survival. And so it gives you a kind of pseudo-objectivity. But in the end, as I've explained, I think that it's not explanatorily plausible.
Okay. Now let's move to the next one, like a much more practical approach, which is utilitarianism or consequentialism. So if we think of Bentham or even modern voices like Sam Harris, so they would say something like the following: what's right is just whatever leads to the most happiness or the least harm. Is this a good way to define morality?
I don't think this is ultimately successful because of the its explanatory stopping point is arbitrary and premature. It's arbitrary because there's no reason to think that the flourishing of human beings is the standard of objective morality any more than the flourishing of other species. In fact, Sam Harris actually says that it is merely the flourishing of sentient life that is the good. Well, we could improve the goodness of the world by then feeding all of our elderly and terminally ill people to rats for food, and that would increase the rat population and thereby increase sentient life and the flourishing of sentient life, and therefore achieve great goodness on Harris's view, which is, I think, morally unconscionable. So the stopping point is arbitrary and implausible. But secondly, it's also not very deep explanatorily. You have to simply say, well, human flourishing is good, and that's it. If you ask, well, why, there is no further explanation. They just say, that's my stopping point. Don't you agree that human flourishing is good? And of course I agree that it's good, but that's because I'm a theist who believes that human beings are created in the image of God and therefore invested with inherent moral worth and moral responsibilities. So theism is a deeper account. It has greater explanatory depth than this premature stopping point of just saying, well, human flourishing is the good, and that's the end of the story.
I understand. And by that you mean like, on which basis are we ascribing to human beings an inherent worth, correct? This is kind of
yes,
your,
that would
your,
be
your
the arbitrariness criticism, that it does seem to be arbitrary, That's right. Okay. But then the further criticism would be that the theory lacks explanatory depth because it can't go beyond the explanatory stopping point of, well, human beings and their flourishing is the good and there is no explanation for it.
Okay, I just want to ask a side question. When you say explanatory depth, how do you contrast this with explanatory power? I know that you've used this you've distinguished between both when you talk about the resurrection of Christ. I remember like you used the same lingo, but can you explain a little bit the difference between explanatory depth and power?
I think that explanatory depth will contribute to the explanatory power of a hypothesis. What I mean by explanatory depth is the levels of explanation that are offered. This is most easy to understand in mathematics, I think. In mathematics, mathematicians do not simply accept an infinite blizzard of truths of arithmetic, like 2 plus 2 is 4, 5 plus 3 is 8, and so on and so on. Rather, these arithmetic truths are theorems which are derived from mathematical axioms, which are fewer in number and more fundamental. So these arithmetic truths are derived from the axioms of Peano arithmetic. And so Peano arithmetic, you see, exhibits greater explanatory depth than just saying, oh, well, there are all these truths of arithmetic, and they're all necessarily true, and that's where I stop. And similarly, theism gives a deeper account of morality than the naturalist is able to do, who simply has a kind of stubborn humanism.
Okay, understood. Now, let's hear your comment on another big one, which is Kantian ethics. So Immanuel Kant, the so-called father of modern ethics, believed we can figure out right and wrong purely through reason. So by asking what rules we would want everyone to follow. So Dr. Craig, does a reason-based morality like Kant's theory really need God in order to stand?
Well, now, Kantian moral theory does feature God because Kant recognized that virtue and happiness do not coincide in this life. In this life, virtuous people often die young and have terrible lives, whereas the wicked flourish and live long. And that seems inconsistent with objective morality. Virtue and happiness should coincide. And so Kant felt that you need to postulate God as the guarantor of the equation of virtue with happiness in the afterlife. So although Kant didn't see God as the source of moral values and duties, he does have an essential role for God to play in his moral theory as the guarantor of the equation of virtue with happiness. Now, in terms of my critique of his view, it would be very similar to what I just said about humanism, namely, it's arbitrary and premature to pick out human beings as the basis of moral values and to think that we have these sorts of duties without God's being a moral lawgiver. I think many of these ethical systems fall prey to the same deficiencies.
Okay, so when they go back to the topic of reason, they say we can use reason to determine ethics. The question is, right?
Yes.
Again, yeah. The issue here is that we believe that reason is, at the end of the day, subjective, correct? It's not an objective foundation on which to base morality on.
Well, we can use reason, I think, to discern the content of the moral good and to discern what our moral duties are. For example, Kant said that we should treat every human person as an end in themselves and not merely as a means to an end. Well, I agree with that categorical imperative. I think that we are morally obligated to treat people as ends and not as mere means that we can use as though they were things. But the theist will say that the reason there is this categorical imperative that we can discern is because it is promulgated by God. God has created human beings in his image, invested with intrinsic moral worth and dignity, and therefore to be treated as ends rather than mere means.
Okay. Going back to your main argument, which is God explains morality, is this also called in the field of philosophy a divine command theory? This is kind of the formal name of this theory?
Divine command theory is indeed my favored theistic view of ethics. That is correct. This theory has been very well articulated by Robert Adams, one of the greatest of the contemporary Christian philosophers, in his book, Finite and Infinite Goods. Adams defended the view that God himself is the good, the paradigm and locus of moral value, and that perfectly good nature expresses itself toward us in the form of divine commands, which then constitute our moral duties. And I think that is an explanatorily deep and very persuasive, plausible, meta-ethical theory. Now, there are other views, other theistic views, but this is the one that I prefer.
Okay, I didn't know that there were other. I thought there was like only one. So if you don't mind, can you like explain a little bit what are the others, or maybe one or two mainstream ones?
Well, one of the most prominent would be so-called natural law theories, that there is a kind of natural law that decrees the ends for which things exist.
And still theistic, correct? It's still a theistic theory.
Yes, that's right. But a theistic theory. And I think in the end, it's not incompatible with divine command theory, because the divine command theorist will say, well, God is the source of the moral law, the natural law that we all discern. He decrees the moral law. So it's not really incompatible, but the emphasis is different.
All right. Okay. Thank you. And when we say God commands certain moral duties.
Yes.
Do you mean by that, for example, the Ten Commandments and love your neighbor as thyself?
Yeah.
Like these are the main commands?
Yes.
Okay. Now, there are also some contract, recently, it looks like these theories are quite popular, social contract theories, so theories based on mutual self-interest, or something even called constructivism. So
yes,
if we think of philosophers like Locke or Hobbes, they argue that morality is basically agreements that we make so we can live peacefully together. And there is another philosopher called Christine Korsgaard who says that morality is something that we create together as a society through discussion and reason. So a little bit similar to the previous ones, but do you want to say something on this, on these latest constructivist or social contract theories?
I don't think that contractarianism or constructivism give us objective morality, because you are always free to opt out of the social contract. The antisocial person doesn't need to agree to the contract, and he does nothing wrong when he behaves differently because he's not part of the contract. In fact, this leads almost immediately to sociocultural relativism, because different societies adopt different contracts. Just think of the difference between national socialist Germany society, Nazi Germany, and the Western democracies, or apartheid South Africa, or Maoist Chinese society. Clearly, there were different values in place, And no one could say that one of them is right and the others are wrong, because there is no transcendent vantage point by which to compare and criticize these different social contracts. And what I want to say is that given the existence of God, we have such a transcendent vantage point where we can say of Nazi Germany that that whole society had gone wrong, that it was on a terrible path ethically and resulted in horrible moral atrocities as a result. And that requires this transcendent vantage point. The Nazi ethic could not be discredited from within. It was only from without, from an external vantage point, that one could say this society's morality was wrong.
I understand. Okay. Now, finally, there's also moral intuitionism that I would like to discuss with you. So the view that we all just know that some things are right or wrong, like fairness or, for example, not hurting others. So philosophers like George Edward Moore defended this kind of approach. Why wouldn't that be enough, like moral intuitions?
If I understand this right, it seems to me that this is primarily a theory about moral epistemology rather than moral ontology. Our moral intuitions can help to guide us in discerning the content of the good and our moral duties and prohibitions. And I agree with that. I think when we reflect morally upon human persons and how they're to be treated, that we do have these deep moral intuitions. In fact, the Bible actually teaches this. In Romans, Paul's letter to the Romans, chapter 2, Paul says that the moral law of God is written on the hearts of all men, so that they do instinctually by nature what the law requires, even though they do not have the Jewish law. And so the Bible actually teaches that there is this kind of intuitive grasp of right and wrong and the demands of God's moral law.
I see. So you see it more as an epistemological approach rather than an ontological explanation, correct?
Yes, I think so.
Okay, I understand. Dr. Craig, over the years, as you've thought and written so much about morality, has your own view of morality changed over time, or maybe deepened in a certain way?
Well, I definitely think that as a result of studying the work of theorists like Robert Adams, whom I've already mentioned, as well as theorists like Philip Quinn, William Alston, definitely my grasp of divine command morality, the basis for values and moral duties, has been made more profound. Hearing Alston's response to the Euthyphro dilemma, I thought was decisive for me. And so quite definitely, there's been, I think, real growth in my own life in understanding the basis of moral values and duties in God.
I see. And as everybody knows, everybody who follows your work knows, you've also used the moral argument as one of the powerful arguments to talk about the existence of God. So if I remember it well, it's as follows, and correct me if I'm wrong. So if God does not exist, objective moral values and duties do not exist. Premise number two, objective moral values and duties do exist, then God exists, correct?
Right. Yes, this is a simple, logically airtight argument, both of whose premises I think are true. And it's so interesting to me, Jack, in discussing this argument with unbelievers, I find that the vast majority of people believe both of these premises. They believe that if there is no God, then everything is relative, that there is no objective morality. But they also believe that some things, at least, are really right and wrong. They've just never put the two together to draw the logical inference from it. And in talking to an unbeliever, it can sometimes be almost comical to see them jump back and forth between these premises. When you talk about the first premise, they agree with you but deny the second. Then when you move to the second premise and talk about it, they agree with you on that but deny the first.
Oh.
So they go back and forth, unable to decide. It would be funny if it weren't so sad to see folks desperately trying to avoid God as a foundation for morality.
I see. And you've also said that it's actually one of the most powerful arguments compared to the other arguments. Why is that so? Is it because we can relate to it?
The reason is for what the reason I just said is that most people believe both premises. And therefore, it's an extremely powerful argument. As I've often said, you can ignore the evidence for the beginning of the universe if you want to. You don't need to think about the fine tuning of the universe. But every day you get up, you answer by how you treat other people whether you think that they are merely means to an end to be used by you, or whether you think they are ends in themselves to be treated with respect and dignity. And therefore, the moral argument is inescapable. By our behavior, we answer every day whether or not we think that objective moral values and duties exist.
I see. It is indeed a very powerful argument. Although my preferred one is the Kalam cosmological argument. I'm an engineer by education, and I like science. But yeah,
you know, that is so interesting, Jack, because Jan and I have found over the years that engineers just love my material. There's something about engineers that just attracts them to this. And I think it's because engineering is so logical. Engineers have to be logical and careful in how they think. And so they love this approach to Christian belief.
Absolutely. Yeah, it makes total sense. I think all the arguments that you talk about and during your debates, all of them are quite powerful and interesting, except one that is a little bit baffling, I would say, which is the ontological argument.
I knew you were going to say that.
But
yes, I have a fellow in my defenders class that I teach who says, I can't think that anyone would be convinced of the existence of God by the ontological argument. And yet I have to tell you that there is tremendous interest in this argument. And of the different videos that Reasonable Faith has produced on the various theistic arguments, the video that is the most viewed of all of them is the one on the ontological argument. So people are genuinely fascinated by this, and I'm convinced that it is a sound and cogent argument.
I've tried to look at it multiple times. I've seen the old formulation from Saint Anselm, and then I've seen also the new one that you talk about, based on Alvin Plantinga's formulation.
Right, and the modal version.
The modal, yes, correct. And it's astonishing because one starts with uttering some words, and then the words become themselves. Like, you know, it is possible that God exists, and at the end of the argumentation, we conclude, if it's possible that God exists, then God exists.
Yeah.
And it's so it is really like kind of difficult to maybe conceive of. But with repetition and with separating the premise as you do, I think it becomes clearer and easier to digest. But I still struggle with this one, to be honest.
Well, you know, it requires some reflection upon the nature of modality, upon possibility and necessity. And what's key to the argument is that if something is possibly necessary, then it is necessary. It doesn't matter if you reiterate those modal operators in front of one another. If something is possibly necessary, then it is necessary. And so if it's possible that there exists a maximally great being, then it follows that he does exist.
Yes, yes, I see. And this is probably how in ancient times they used to use that argument, like God is the most, like the most, like the biggest or the greatest entity that one can imagine of. And if it exists, then if it's possible that it exists, then it exists, correct? This is kind
right.
of...
Right, that's the idea. And so the real question is it possible? That's the real question. And so I often, in talking with atheists, don't try to answer that question. I just leave it with them. I say, what do you think? Do you think it's possible that God exists? If you're going to be an atheist, you have to believe that it's impossible for God to exist. And then just leave them to think about it.
So basically premise number one. This is
that's premise number one.
And all rests on this premise. If they accept this, which they should, because unless someone is sure that God does not exist, how can they be sure about that? That's another extreme position, correct?
So unless you could show a contradiction in the concept of God or some sort of incoherence. For example, it's impossible that a square circle exists.
It's logically incoherent.
Correct? Yeah, exactly. But the concept of God isn't like that. The concept of God seems to be perfectly coherent.
So, Dr. Craig, looking ahead, what are you working on these days that you're most excited about? I know that you are working on a multi-volume, systematic.
I have a magnificent obsession to write a systematic philosophical theology. I have been working on this for the last 5 years, and I have now completed 4 out of the 5 projected volumes. And I am currently writing the final volume 5. And so this has been a dream come true. I continue to be stretched to grow intellectually every week as I wrestle with these subjects. It's been like being a student again. And so it's been a wonderful experience putting all this together.
Well, that's fantastic. Is this like a set of books addressed to everybody, or it's addressed to only people who are specialized in philosophy?
I have to make a decision in this regard, Jack. And I want this series or these volumes to have an influence far beyond my lifetime for decades to come. And therefore, it is written for specialists. It is not a book for lay people. This is written for other philosophers and theologians and scientists who want to probe the deep issues raised by the Christian faith. Now, when I'm finished with these 5 volumes, I'll probably, God willing, reduce them to a single popular level volume that would be accessible to the layman. Now, in the meantime, that material is available on our website as my Defenders series of lectures. There you will find a whole series of lectures from the doctrine of Scripture through Doctrine of the Last Things that covers the same material at a popular level. So it is available on the website already.
All right, it's good to know. Well, that feels like the perfect place to end our conversation, Dr. Craig. It's been such a pleasure having you on the RJK podcast. Thank you for sharing your wisdom and having this meaningful dialogue with us today. And of course, best of luck with your ongoing work on the systematic philosophical theology project. Sorry, I know many people are eager to see it fully come to life. So thanks again.
Well, you're welcome. It's been an enjoyable conversation today, Jack. God bless you and your further work.
Thank you very much. God bless you. Take care.